Welcome to the City Club of Eugene, September 21st, 2018 program, ballot measures 102, local government bonds for affordable housing. City Club is coming to you from the University of Oregon's Baker Center at 10th and High Streets in Eugene. This is the third program of our 2018-19 program. I'm Joel Curran, president. Support for your City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. We have both business and in-kind sponsors. Our diamond sponsor is Kaiser Permanente, that exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services and to improve the health care of our members and communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. Our program coordinators today for this Measure 102 program are Kyle Shavir and Randy Prince, and Randy will introduce the program.
Hello, and welcome to the City Club of Eugene's second election-related program for fall 2018. In the spotlight today, Measure 102, a legislative referral that would amend a provision in Oregon's Constitution that dates all the way back to our statehood, 1859. Article 11, Section 9 prohibits governments in our state from borrowing, selling bonds, in order to invest in projects that are not owned by the public. Well, advocates for affordable housing would like to repeal that ban to permit direct public investment in privately owned housing projects. Now, for all of us on the West Coast, it'd be hard to miss the fact there's a problem finding an affordable place to live sometimes. The problem affects owner-occupied and rented housing and the supply of manufactured home sites. There's also a shortage of temporary shelters for those who are simply without any place of their own. That's the unhoused. Inflation of housing costs is not a new problem. Many U.S. cities experienced it in the last century. Government entities built large rental housing projects. You can still see those buildings in places like New York. Others can no longer be seen. Thousands of units in Chicago and St. Louis were demolished after it was concluded they were a failure, either socially or financially. And government policy then shifted towards supporting the private sector in providing housing for those in need. Nevertheless, public financing for publicly owned housing has lately increased. City of Portland voters recently approved a large bond measure for affordable housing, and a second bond measure sponsored by the Portland Regional Government Metro for over $652 million is on the November ballot. The bond measures supplement other efforts to increase the supply of affordable housing, many of which do involve supporting public-private partnerships with other types of subsidies like tax credits, property tax reduction. Today, you will hear the case for changing Oregon's Constitution to allow money raised from government bonds to support these kind of public-private partnerships. Today's program differs from other election-related programs on the City Club's fall calendar. Yes, we will have presentations, and there's a question and answer period. But as for our presentations, today it's a one-sided show. When we scheduled this program, we knew the momentum was with the advocates of the constitutional amendment. The referral passed in the House without opposition and the Senate just 5 votes against it. No committees have organized in opposition, no money spent, no statements by public figures against it, no letters to the editor were noticed. The early edition of the state voters pamphlet came out in the last couple weeks. One individual citizen submitted an argument in opposition. On the other side, 16 statements representing dozens of organizations and politicians supporting the constitutional amendment. We know some people have their doubts, but it's really not our place to decide who to book as a speaker when no one has stepped forward in any official way. But if you're the person who would like to say the emperor has no clothes, we are so glad you're here. We will have table discussions and questions from the tables following the presentations. Our presenters are Emily Ryman, and she's the executive director of the Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation, NEDCO. NEDCO is a nonprofit community development corporation that has worked since 1979 to make sure people in Lane, Marion, and Clackamas counties have the tools and resources they need to build a brighter financial future. Prior to working for NEDCO, Emily completed the ABCs of home buying class through the organization, and now she helps others realize their dream of being homeowners. an avid book reader, she spends her downtime turning pages in her latest bookstore find or spending time with her family. Karen Knudsen. Karen is an architect and urban designer who serves on the steering committee for Better Housing Together. Better Housing Together is an organization dedicated to creating solutions to the growing housing crisis in the Eugene area. Karen's a partner at Larco Knudsen, teaches architecture and urban design at the U of O College of Design, and is a board member of the Architecture Foundation of Oregon. And she's on first, so let's welcome Karen.
Thank you, Randy, and thank you for the invitation to join you all today. As Randy mentioned, Better Housing Together is a collaborative and community-led effort to address housing affordability, diversity, and supply in Lane County. And with more than 40 partners, both businesses and organizations dedicated to working on these challenges, you can bet that we spend a lot of time working on and talking about partnership and what we need to do together to address the local housing crisis. And that, I would say, is the most important fundamental concept for you all to be thinking about and for us to be thinking about today, the idea of partnership and the potential of partnership. When we see value in partnership, how we believe in it, and the necessity of partnership if we're going to take meaningful action to address the housing crisis in Lane County. So Randy and Kyle asked me to provide a little bit of context, and some of what I'll share today is research generated with the assistance of Oregon Law Center, Legal Aid of Lane County, and also the bond attorney Harvey Rogers' presentation to the Senate Rules Committee last February to understand the constitutional limits on the use of general obligation bond proceeds. You can bet that was a riveting presentation. Since the Constitution was signed, Oregon has limited general obligation bond financing for the benefit of certain types of private entities. It's been over 160 years since that Constitution was signed, and we have learned a lot and changed a lot in the intervening generations. Oregon's Constitution has been amended many times since it was signed, including the introduction of the direct legislative system that allows ballot initiatives like Measure 102 to exist. And when that Constitution was approved by voters, Article 11, Section 9 was included. That's the topic of Measure 102. And that article and section read, "No county, city, town, or other municipal corporation, by vote of its citizens or otherwise, shall become a stockholder in any joint company, corporation, or association whatever, or raise money for or loan its credit to, or in the aid of, any such company, corporation, or association." Now, the general understanding is this was related to the sort of brute force of railroads in the late 1800s and how those influenced local politics. It's also understood that this language was cribbed almost directly from the Indiana State Constitution, a lot of sharing back and forth between Oregon and Indiana. And bond attorneys say the section is clear about the prohibition of stock ownership. But what else it does isn't as clear, and that's in part because so little has been said about this article and section in the last 160 years. It was amended once in 1917 to allow the lending of credit to ports, so we have in fact evolved our thinking about how we think about this work. And also, more than 100 years ago, the Oregon Supreme Court used this section to invalidate a city bond issue that would have financed railroad improvements, so again, railroad rearing its head. So how is this relevant now? First, Measure 102 is fundamentally an issue related to local control. It is not in Lane County related to a housing bond. Portland metro area is on the same ballot considering a specific housing bond to address affordable housing. In Lane County, that is not the concern. But it is an amendment that would allow local governments to work with nonprofits and local businesses to build affordable housing using bond funding. So that's the first kind of big picture piece. It expands the possibility for partnerships and the flexibility of funding to address the affordable housing crisis. Secondly, and probably more importantly, and Emily can speak to this in great detail, Because modern affordable housing transactions often involve organizations and businesses that are legally organized as corporations, there's a disconnect between the utilization of public bond funding for affordable housing projects and most of the other major tools that we use to make these projects financially feasible. So three quick examples of that. Low-income housing tax credits are the workhorse of affordable housing financing. That tool has been used to build millions and millions of units of affordable housing over the past several decades. But in order to access those tax credits, the housing project must be owned by a corporation or similar entity, which would mean it would not be able to access bond funding. Another example from HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Agency, HUD makes loans to low-income housing projects, and typically it is also required that those loans be owned by a separate corporation or similar entity, again disqualifying collaboration and partnership and blending of those funding streams. And then thirdly, both private and nonprofit developers who focus on affordable housing are understandably interested in owning the housing that they have financed and developed. There's lots of reasons why that is the case, but again, that would not be possible with the current structure that Measure 102 is working to address. So the most effective tools that we are currently using to finance affordable housing cannot be easily combined with local government bonds, and the amendment described in Measure 102 would change that. It's a small but potentially significant impact for communities who are weighing specific funds, public funds and bonds to fund affordable housing. As local funds designated to addressing that challenge would be able to go farther to create more housing units and to leverage the capacity of both the public and private sector. There's a very particular example in Portland where with the passage of Measure 102 and the specific bond that the Portland Metro communities are considering, the number of housing units that would be able to be built expands significantly, and the number of households addressed, I believe, expands from about 7,500 to closer to 13,000. So it's a big change in what we can do with the money that is available. Without an amendment to Article 11 and Section 9, local governments can still use general obligation bonds to finance affordable housing. That does not change. But what does change is that the housing must be owned and controlled by a local government, which would mean, for example, the city of Eugene, the city of Springfield would be your landlord in your home if you lived in a housing unit developed using that bond funding. And also, this projects cannot combine bond financing with the many other conventional housing tools that I just mentioned. So it simply makes addressing a challenge that is always that is already difficult and significant more difficult, less opportunity to think creatively about how to make these projects feasible. Randy asked me what could possibly go wrong in thinking about Measure 102 and amending the Constitution. And I thought quite a bit about that. It's pretty, we can pretty simply cartoon, sort of extreme positions relative to how we think about the public and private sector related to housing. That the private sector should not be involved at all, that the public sector should not be involved at all, and that truly the path forward, if we're serious about addressing these issues, is going to require us to think more creatively and more collaboratively about engaging both of those sectors more efficiently and more effectively, using all of the resources and expertise that we have access to. That's the challenge ahead of us to address the crisis of affordable housing and housing affordability that we face in Lane County. Another thing that could go wrong is that we could misunderstand how bonds work and also how affordable housing is created and how it is regulated and what sort of compliance expectations are in place. And the work to deliver affordable housing units is incredibly challenging. Talk to any nonprofit affordable housing developer or builder who works with affordable housing and you could fill books with explanations of the regulations and requirements necessary in order to prove that what has been promised is being delivered and that those units are doing what was lined out in many different layers of compliance documentation and requirements. So it's complex work and there are a lot of layers of regulation in place to make sure that it delivers. What that means is also that there are many layers of regulation in place, which drives up the cost of delivering affordable housing, as you can imagine. So we're going to have to weigh some of these challenges as we think about our paths into the future. I'll say lastly that in thinking about this and how not, how to move closer to right solutions and move in directions where we're thinking about what we've accomplished as a community, we really need to work to address both the cost structure related to delivering housing units and also the funding strategies for affordable housing and also for to address housing affordability more broadly. So what could we do to address that? Our work is really quite focused on efforts related to increasing affordability, diversity, and supply. And I'll tell you quickly why those three things are so important. One is that, of course, affordability has to be a focus. When so few people working in this community can afford what is now the average cost of a home or the average rent, work needs to be done to expand opportunities for people to access stable housing. So what can we do to steer the housing market towards types of housing that our community needs more of? And how can we make it feasible for builders, developers, private and nonprofit, to create housing that is accessed at a typical wage, both rentership housing and home ownership? To address affordability via cost structure and not just public subsidy, we need to have access to a wider range of housing options. It's housing diversity is how that is commonly discussed. If we have more access to a wider range of housing options, we will have more price points in the market, and we will have more housing that suits the needs of the households that are seeking shelter. So that includes the design of quality units that fit into walkable neighborhoods and that serve smaller households, single individuals or couples or small families. Both the state of Oregon and even the city of Springfield have already taken steps in this direction by creating new laws and code and incentives that encourage the development of units like backyard cottages, accessory dwelling units, ADUs commonly. And it remains to be seen how Eugene will engage with the challenge of expanding this access. How will we actually make it possible to deliver these units to the market and house people more easily? One question that we've heard actually quite a bit related to that and to accessory dwelling units specifically is, do they help affordability? You know, they're so expensive to build, how could they possibly help affordability? And the good news is that the research that has come back has indicated that yes, in fact, they do. Portland State University just completed a fairly expansive report that found that accessory dwelling units in the metro area of Portland are renting at a price point below a one-bedroom apartment. Above affordable housing, but below a one-bedroom apartment, which means that they are, in actuality, filling in a rung of the housing ladder, expanding affordability and expanding diversity in the Portland metro area. And that's an important thing to think about when we find ourselves weighing how that could help in this community. Lastly, sort of basic thinking about supply and demand. The big takeaway there is that we need more housing. As new housing is built, quality older housing becomes more affordable. This is a process that occurs in every community throughout our country, around the world. It's simply known as filtering. And that happens only when new housing comes onto the market. In the absence of new housing coming to market, the most expensive housing is the nicest housing. It doesn't matter how old it is or its actual quality, it's simply relatively better than the rest of the housing available in that market. It's why we need to think about housing supply when we're thinking about impacting affordability and even affordable housing, because we want for there to be more options and we want for that filtering to naturally occur in the community. So none of what we're talking about are simple challenges or one-vote solutions. Voting yes for Measure 102 will not solve the housing crisis in Lane County. Voting yes for Measure 102 and the affordable housing bond that Portland is considering will not solve the Portland metro area's affordable housing crisis. But these are steps in a direction that will help our community be more flexible and creative as we're looking for solutions. And that's, I think, the reason why we want to seriously weigh this decision and be encouraged about the possibility of having more partners in the future. So now Emily is going to do more to explain the work that's underway to deliver affordable housing and just how complex that process already is.
Uh, Good afternoon. I want to echo Karin's thanks to the room today for having us here to talk about it. I know it's a little bit of a unique setup that we don't have the traditional pro-con going on. I'm happy about that. I'm grateful that there is such universal support for this measure. And thank you for having us anyway so that we can highlight the issues and highlight some of the complexities. As said in the introduction, I'm the director of NEDCO. NEDCO is one of your local affordable housing developers. There are others. St. Vinny's is a big one. Homes for Good is a big one. Cornerstone Community Housing is a big one. We are lucky enough in this community to have some truly exceptional affordable housing developers. And yet none of us can meet the need. And a lot of that has to do with the restrictions on funding that exist. When we talk about affordable housing, there are a lot of different meanings of what affordable can be. I'm talking about affordable housing. I think of it as capital A, capital H, right? We're not talking about housing that happens to be affordable. We're talking about housing that is developed very specifically for the lowest income members of our community. And oftentimes we're thinking about that population as the 20% of the lowest income earners in our community. So if you break up our community into fifths, let's look at the bottom 20. And generally speaking, that category can afford less than $600 a month in rent. Some of that population can afford zero. They have no income. Others can afford up to $600 a month. So we're talking about something that is so far outside the range of the market that we actually have to bring public subsidy into this building to be able to house those individuals. And that's where you get the capital A, capital H. There's just no way for the market to address this. We have to have funding. Historically speaking, much of that public subsidy for affordable housing has come from the federal government. And it's come in various complicated forms. Karin mentioned tax credits. Low-income housing tax credits are probably the biggest source of funding for affordable housing in the country. And just to give you an example of the complexity of this product, you don't need to remember any of these details. I'm just going to list them off so that you get an idea of the complexity. Low-income housing tax credits actually are not dollars that come to NEDCO or to St. Vinny's or to Homes for Good to develop housing. Low-income housing tax credits are a tax credit that is granted by HUD to a state housing finance agency, so in Oregon, Oregon Housing and Community Services. OHCS then puts out an application for developers like NEDCO to apply to receive an allocation of tax credits. So we might apply for $10 million in tax credits. But that's not us applying for $10 million to build housing. That's us applying for $10 million of the right to grant somebody tax credits. If we get that award from OHCS, we then have to go find an investor who has tax liability that wants to buy those tax credits and will buy them from us at some sort of exchange rate. So it might not be dollar for dollar. For a while, they were trading actually a little bit above a dollar, so they might pay us $1.05 for every dollar of tax credits that we sell them. Right now, that's not the case. They're trading at like 85 cents on the dollar. So that $10 million award turns into $8.5 million of tax credits from an investor like Wells Fargo or some other large financial institution that wants to minimize their tax liability and invest in affordable housing. So you can imagine how complicated this transaction gets as we have attorneys involved at every level and tax credit consultants involved at every level, and there's an exchange that has to happen. It's not easy to access these dollars, right? So there's a couple of reasons that's important today. One reason is that most municipal governments don't have any interest in playing in this game. Portland might be the only one that has the capacity in Oregon to actually have staff with expertise in that area or that wants to try to develop housing that is that complex. The other is that when you have deals that involve that level of complexity and that level of investor involvement, you oftentimes are having to create separate entities. So you have to create a separate legal entity that investor can be an owner of, a majority owner of, for a certain duration of the project. Other funding sources require that you create a single asset entity. So you have to have a legal entity that only owns that one housing asset. And that's the only way you can get funding to play ball with that particular deal. So if cities are able to issue bonds right now that they can't, you know, that those dollars can't go to any other private entity, nonprofit, for-profit, whatever flavor of entity that is, it means that those bond dollars can't be, they can't be paired with any other source of public funding that is coming into affordable housing. So that's the crux of the hurdle that we face, and it's why this particular component of our constitutional amendment is causing such havoc on us trying to utilize bond funding at a city or a county level to further develop affordable housing in our community. It just isn't feasible with that one clause of our constitution, and that's what we're trying to reverse. I want to reiterate what Karin said, which is the question before us on the ballot this November is not whether Eugene should have an affordable housing bond or whether any particular entity in Oregon should have an affordable housing bond. That's a question that we're going to have to face as a town down the road. All we're trying to do right now is remove that little bit of the Constitution for affordable housing. And again, this change is very narrowly focused. So the change would not allow cities or counties to lend their credit for any project. It would allow them to lend their credit only for affordable housing bonds, very specifically. So it's this tiny little change that we're trying to make to the Constitution that would open up a wide range of possible tools for local cities and counties to adopt on behalf of affordable housing. And I think that's an important distinction to make today. As an affordable housing advocate, as an advocate on behalf of 102, I get a lot of questions about sort of variants on a theme of, well, how do we know that the money is going to be well spent? How do we know that this is the right, that, you know, we might pass a bond and then what's going to happen to that money? How do we know that this is a trustworthy source, that this is a good move on our behalf? So I want to tell you a little bit more about not just the financing tools, but how these deals come together. So as an affordable housing developer, we might have an idea for a project. We want to build 50 units somewhere in Eugene. We have this parcel of land that we have control of or that we own, and we want to put this project together. The first thing I will say is that I have never seen a project come together with a single source of funding. Partly this has to do with declining funds at the federal level. Funds have been declining for the better part of 30 years into affordable housing. As other funding sources pop up, no funder wants to be 100% of the project. They want to know that you have other funding. They want to know that you have other support. They want their dollars to stretch as far as possible. So they may be willing to put in $20,000 per unit or $50,000 per unit, or they may be willing to be the last 10% of the project, but they want you to have the other 90% already lined up. And in fact, oftentimes, you get points based on how many dollars you can leverage compared to theirs. So we get points, we might score better, we might have a better shot at getting a particular pot of funding if we can say, look, we already have these other three sources lined up and we're actually going to leverage your dollars 5-1 if you will invest in this project or if you'll grant into this project. It is not unusual for an affordable housing project to have 8 or 10 or 12 different funding sources into it. I've heard horror stories about projects that have 18 and 20 different funding sources into it, but I hope to never be part of one of those. For each of those funding sources, there is going to be a different application that we as the developer have to go through. In that application, they outline the parameters of what they're willing to fund, what population they're willing to have their dollars target, what percentage of the project it can be, whether they're willing to pay for land or for infrastructure or for the unit development or for services. It's usually not all of those. It's usually one or two of those. So again, it turns into this puzzle of how do we piece together the right overlapping sources that all have sort of the right lineup and all complement each other to get to whatever the total dollars are that we need to develop these 50 units. For all of those funders, we then have to propose a very detailed application. We can't say, hey, we have this plot of land, we'd like to build 50 units on it, give us, you know, $15 million. We have to have site plans, we have to have architectural plans, we have to have the design for the units, we have to commit to what bedroom size all of the units are going to be, we have to commit to which population we're going to serve, we have to commit to the rents that we are going to charge, either at what median income they will be affordable or what percentage of somebody's income we can ask from them to contribute. All of that has to be spelled out in incredible detail. In the financial pro forma, we have to outline not only all of the costs for land and construction and architectural fees and every bit of the construction and development, we also have to outline what our developer fee is going to be. So this is essentially the sort of profit and overhead line that allows me to pay for the staff that actually develop this project and that manage the construction project. So we also have to spell out all of that detail, and usually there are very strict limits on what percentage of the project that can be or how much per unit that can be. We propose that, and there is then an evaluation process. So whoever is in charge of the funding source, be it a private funder or a public funder, they then go through an underwriting process to see if that project is viable, if it's going to financially pencil, if we have the expertise that we need to know that we can develop this project and we can follow through with it. All of that is evaluated, and then we get a decision back on that particular funding source. So you can imagine going through that process 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 times to try to line up the funding for these projects. We have eyes on them like you wouldn't believe to make sure that they are viable projects and that they're gonna work in the long term. The other part of that is that all 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 of those funders then have compliance and monitoring rights over us for the duration of that project. One of the things that they specify, I forgot to mention this, is what we call the affordability period. So with any given source of funds, not only do we have to commit to a certain level of affordability, so for example, we have to say these apartments will always be affordable to somebody making 30% of the median income, and that's going to be, you know, X dollars in this year, and it might go up a little bit over time. We also then have a commitment that affordability has to last for 20 years or 30 years or 40 years. The tax credit affordability is 60 years. We have to guarantee the affordability of those units for 60 years. So for 60 years, that entity has the right to come in and monitor us, and they do generally annually. To make sure that the financials of the project are performing, to make sure that we are doing our job income qualifying the people who live there and that we're updating that income qualification on an annual basis, to make sure that we're providing the services we committed to. Because generally speaking, we're not just committing to build housing, we're also committing to provide services to the population that lives there. And we have to make sure that we provide those services for 60 years or for whatever the affordability period is. So again, we have many people and many eyes on these projects and on our work for the entire affordability period of the project. That's going to be the same for bond funding that is issued. So when any city contemplates a bond for affordable housing, they'll have to specify what does affordability mean and what population is that going to serve and what type of housing is that going to create. And they then, when they, you know, they'll issue the application where developers can come in and propose the projects that would be built with that funding, and they'll have all the same monitoring rights and compliance and performance period. Plus, presumably, if we get this amendment passed, we will be able to use these bond funds layered with tax credits and other state funding sources and other local funding sources, so it will not just be the city coming in and making sure that we're doing what we said we would do with the bond funding, but the state will be coming in and making sure that we're doing what we said with the tax credit funding, and the bank will be coming in to make sure that we are doing what we said we'd do with the private financing. So they will be, these projects will be as carefully monitored as any other affordable housing project that's out there, that's built. I would also say, NEDCO is a nonprofit developer, and we work very closely with the other nonprofit developers in this community. I hope, of course, that if a bond does pass at some point, that nonprofit developers will play in that sphere and will use that money to build projects. I will be the first to admit that nonprofit developers are not enough. Our housing crisis is such in the state of Oregon and in this country that nonprofit developers can't produce the number of units that we need. We also need the private sector. We need private developers to be playing in this world also. Many of them won't because of all the stuff that I just described, and it's not worth it to them to have to jump through all of those hoops. But there are some who are willing, and all of the same criteria I just described, all of the same limits, all of the same oversight, all of the same affordability period applies for a private developer. So a private developer coming in and utilizing these funds has to perform in all of the same ways that a nonprofit developer has to perform too. And I, as a nonprofit developer, still have to have a developer fee line item in that proforma because I still have to pay my staff too. So for me, I think it's important that that we have systems of funding that allow both nonprofit and for-profit developers to team up and to form alliances to try to get units on the ground for low-income families. And that we can only do that with affordable housing bond money if we fix this constitution, if we pass this constitutional amendment. The last thing that I want to say is just about the scope of the problem that we face. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about need because I think there's a lot of common recognition in our community about the need for affordable housing. But what a lot of people don't realize is that when I started talking, I said the majority of funding historically has come from the federal government. And that has been declining for many, many years. And for a long time, for a lot of years, there were not new sources to come in and complement the federal dollars. The state of Oregon has been working for the last probably 8 or 10 years. Affordable housing advocates, affordable housing developers, but also people from the education community and the healthcare community and local governments. There is a huge alliance forming in our state, recognizing that affordable housing and the lack of housing isn't just a housing issue. It's also an education issue. It's also a healthcare issue. It's also a retirement issue, right? If people don't have housing, nothing else in their life is stable. So there is this statewide coalition of people that are forming to try to advocate for dollars at every level. You know, we don't have a whole lot of control over the federal system and what's going on there, although we try to do some advocacy in that area. What we're trying to do in the state is think of all the spectrum of tools that we can bring to bear on this particular problem that we have to tackle, and what resources make sense at the state level, what resources make sense at the city or county level, what resources can we bring from the private sector or from foundations, and how can we just systematically line up all the tools that we can possibly access on behalf of affordable housing. And this is one piece of that puzzle. It's not the only one. This campaign and this effort and the idea that we can use local bonds for affordable housing is one piece of a spectrum that includes 15 or 20 different resources that we're trying to accomplish. But our hope is that by tackling this constitutional amendment, by getting it passed in November, that we open up a really important part of that spectrum for cities and for counties to potentially utilize this tool on behalf of affordable housing in Eugene, in Portland, in towns across Oregon. So just know that it's not the only thing out there right now, but it's one really crucial part of the puzzle. Thank you.
We will now break for 5 minutes for table discussion, formation of questions. One question I'd like answered when you get back is, how do we compare to other states? Do other states, does Indiana still have this constitutional prohibition, or can all other states do the type of financing that you want to do? Okay. Break for 5 minutes. Thank you, folks.
You're listening to KLCC, informing and inspiring listeners for more than a half century. Broadcasting in HD at KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College.
Welcome back. About ready to begin.
Ross Stein, this is for Emily. You mentioned that you need to continue to provide services maybe as long as 60 years after the people move in. I'm wondering just what those services are.
It varies from project to project, but it needs to be population specific. So, for example, if we were building housing for seniors, we might have services related to aging in place, to helping access retirement and Social Security benefits, to health, physical health resources, any number of things related to that population. If we were working with people with severe and persistent mental health issues, the services would need to be related to that. One of the One of the kind of constant problems that we face is that much of the funding that we get to build housing is for building housing. It's for capital construction and costs associated with that. It's not 60 years worth of service dollars. And because our rents are limited, we don't have rents coming in that can subsidize those services. So it's a constant catch-22 that affordable housing developers battle. One of the things we're trying to do to overcome that is actually partner more with local service providers. So I saw Craig Offerman in the room somewhere earlier. Hi, Craig. NEDCO did a 12-unit apartment complex in the Whitaker neighborhood a couple years back for youth aging out of foster care. So we have a limited number of services we can provide in-house for those youth through our property management and resident services program. But we partner really closely with Craig's shop, which has a program built around helping youth aging out of foster care and providing them services. So those types of partnerships can sometimes help us overcome that kind of financial barrier to services. Whether or not I can guarantee that that program will be around in 60 years, I don't know, but I sure hope so. And that's it's something that we're constantly trying to be creative about.
We need more of you this year.
Good point.
Thank you.
Sharon Reed, City Club member. I'm looking for some data. How many affordable housing units have come online in the last 3 to 5 years here in Eugene, Springfield? And then what's the number of units that would greatly ameliorate or lessen the problem?
Am I allowed to call in the audience for help?
Phone a friend.
So, I mean, Stephanie Jennings is in the audience. Can you shout out a round number for the last 3 years? Okay, so her answer was maybe 300-ish for the city of Eugene over the last 3 years. You know, a statistic that I often quote is that that lowest quintile of our population, the lowest 20% of our population, if you look at the number of people we have in Eugene in that group and you look at the housing units that are affordable under $600 a month, we have a gap of 17,000. So 17,000 units is the short answer of what we need. Clearly, we can't accomplish that tomorrow. But what we need to make progress is in the hundreds and thousands of units. It's not in the tens and twelves of units.
My name is Ruth Miller, and I've been a member for quite a while. And I just want to say, NEDCO, I remember when it first started. And I think it's wonderful, the advances and what you've been doing through the years.
Thank you.
So my question is, how are the bonds repaid? What happens if the bonds default?
I am not a bond attorney or city staff who would probably be the better folks to answer that.
Yeah. The bonds would be paid via property taxes. Looking at the structure of the bond that Portland Metro is weighing currently would be the most immediate relevant example of the amount of dollars or cents added per $1,000 of property value to a tax bill.
Otis?
Hi, I'm Otis Hashemeyer. I'm a new member at the City Club, and I think I'm that kid that's going to shout about the clothes that Randy mentioned at the beginning of the show. I'm opposed to Measure 102. I didn't know anything about it until I returned from a cross-country trip with my family, and then I joined the City Club because I was excited about joining the City Club, and then I saw it, and I was like, wow. It looks like it opens the door for a lot of our public money to go to rich developers, for-profit corporations. So I am opposed to 102. It seems to be a continuation of a neoliberal agenda to give money to the rich that began with Reaganomics, which I think we're all alluding to, right? All that money that's been taken away, all the tax benefits that the rich have been getting, it's all kind of a part of it, which is allowed, right? So here it seems Measure 102 amends the Constitution without a consideration of the consequences, and it feels like a hammer that sees every problem as a nail. Developers tell us we have a problem of housing, and the answer is to build more housing. I disagree. I think we have a crisis, and it is one of ever-growing poverty. Ever-growing poverty is a system problem, and that system has been built by people. I'm going to get to my question. Yeah,
okay,
thank you.
Please.
Disparity of wealth is the problem, right? People don't have the money to buy the houses. People don't have the money to rent the houses. Measure 102 would give us money, give our money as an assets to nonprofit corporations. That is impoverishing our community.
And the question is?
No, you can shout at me. My question is, how is the community giving assets to for-profit corporations not impoverishing our community?
I'll answer one part of that question, and then I think Emily, as a nonprofit affordable housing developer, can answer the other part, which is that Measure 102 would be a step towards allowing nonprofit and for-profit corporations to engage directly in the provision of building affordable housing. As I think was really clearly and expansively described, that's not easy work. It's not uncomplicated work, and it's not work that doesn't include layers and layers of regulatory compliance. It is also incredibly important that we understand that as we're working to address the larger systemic issues that were alluded to in that question, that the provision of stable housing within the community is a necessity while we work on other community challenges. So we have to do this work simultaneously, and we have to look for opportunities to be creative, and we need more partners to address the crisis that we're facing locally. A statistic that Better Housing Together uses often to help people understand the challenge we're facing is the United Way's ALICE report. ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed. These are the working individuals and families in our community who are at the edge of the safety net, that are struggling month to month to meet basic needs. 44% of this community falls below the ALICE threshold, which means that we have a lot of work to do to provide the range of housing types that can allow for people to have the stability they need to both build assets and pursue opportunities.
I would just add a couple of thoughts to that, all of which I agree with wholeheartedly. One is that we actually need housing units, period. I don't disagree that income disparity is a problem, but we are just missing units. And so part of the problem is also getting units on the ground. I would also add, just reiterate, that affordable housing is not a lucrative business. These projects often pencil by $10. And we're oftentimes operating on margins that are tiny, and we're having to bootstrap just to do that. So for nonprofit, for-profit, I don't care who it is in this game, nobody's getting rich if it's being done well, and if it's being monitored well, it's being done well. I would also add that in Eugene, NEDCO, St. Vinny's, HAXA, Cornerstone, we're the ones producing the vast majority of those 300 units. And we're lucky to have the strength of nonprofit developers that we have here.
I think most of us in this room would agree that the last presidential election didn't go as we would want. We know there's a huge defection in this country from either of the major political parties. I would say that the reason for that is on at least the Democratic side, but I would argue possibly on all sides, is that we are entrenched in an economic system of corporate welfare. And I think it is because of deregulatory measures such as this one, which privatizes public funds, that accounts for the experiences of people where we are further impoverished, and it is a form of corporate welfare. And I would like to hear from either of you on how you might relate what happened in the last election to deregulatory measures such as this one.
Thank you.
I will go back to one of the thoughts that I offered to this room at the beginning, which is that especially at the local level and especially in communities where you know your friends and neighbors and want to meet those neighbors that you don't know yet, that believing in partnership and doing the hard work in community to build partnership is part of our path forward and part of the way in which we repair the bonds that are fraying in our community and the ways in which we build a broader understanding of the challenges we face. I think it's fair to say that people are facing a diversity of challenges in our community, and that when you are an individual or a family in crisis, it's easy perhaps to think that your set of challenges are the only challenges. We need to do a better job of understanding the diversity of need and then responding effectively to that. I really think local partnership is a part of the solution.
I'm going to add two things and then I'm going to move on because I feel like we're beating this one. One is that it was absolutely the nonprofit affordable housing development community who championed this change. This is not coming from for-profit developers. This is coming from the nonprofits who want to be able to develop housing, and we want more tools to do it. So we're the ones that have been asking for this from the very beginning. The second is that affordable housing bonds and affordable housing are not without regulation. There will be a lot of eyes on these. There will be a lot of regulations on these. It's simply allowing us to bring new partners into the process.
Scott?
Scott Coltrane, City Club member. And my question relates to past research that looks at mixed income housing. I wonder what the prospects are for multiple unit complexes to include both market rate housing and affordable housing and maybe commercial on the first floor?
It's a great question, and certainly a building typology and a type of housing that would be really exciting to see more of in our community. The reason why is obvious. If you have buildings, in particular projects, that have mixed income, it is more sustainable to integrate levels of affordable housing with those projects where you can subsidize that rent with market rate rents. Those projects are very difficult to accomplish because of the financing structure in place for projects. And again, Measure 102 would be a step towards increasing the opportunity that we have to use different funding streams to accomplish more creative projects. In the private sector, you hear, really good developers, people who build quality projects and contribute to the development of great places, talk about creativity and the desire to see more creativity. And that's not just within the private sector, but that's also speaking to and looking towards their public sector partners. We need to work on that piece of the puzzle.
Hey, James Barber, Springfield City Club member. Two quick questions. One, you mentioned private developers, they don't currently want to jump through all the hoops that you've got to jump through. How would Measure 102 change that so that they will want to jump through those same hoops that they supposedly still have to jump through? So that wasn't quite clear. And then two, I hear complaints that affordable housing isn't well defined, or it isn't defined at the state level, and there's concern for potential abuse. So while it doesn't sound like that's an issue for NEDCO, it might not be so transparent with the private developers. So do we know of any efforts at the state level in the legislature to address those concerns so that there's no doubt these bonds will target that bottom 20%?
So there is not conversation at the state level, but as I understand it, John, correct me if I'm wrong, the cities have to define what they mean by affordable in the bond. So each city is going to address that question, and then voters will see what that definition is, and that's part of what they will be voting on. So each community will be able to address that, which I think is the right place for it to be addressed, because in different communities, affordable means different things. And I think that's actually the right choice. Back to your first question about, plus, John's Van Lanningham is adding, plus the annual audit.
It has to be reported out to the
citizens. Oh, yes, yes. So once the bond is passed, there will be an annual audit that has to be reported out. Yes, thank you. I don't think Measure 102 is going to fix the problem of getting more private developers in. That wasn't what I meant to imply. What I meant to imply was that there actually aren't a lot of private developers in this sphere because it is so complicated. It's a common fear that I'm hearing from a few folks that somehow this is going to be a windfall for private developers. And my point is private developers aren't making a windfall if they're developing affordable housing, and not many of them are developing it at all. This, I don't think, is going to change that, although hopefully the local dollars are a bit more flexible than some of the federal dollars and might bring a little bit of ease to the complexity of the projects. Might a little.
Mike?
Mike Rose, City Council member. The bond issue clearly lifts one barrier to providing funding and collecting that funding to make affordable housing possible. My question involves, what other barriers are in place in Lane County or the city or county government that also need looking at as possibilities of making affordable housing easier to come by?
That is a great question, and this is Karen. Funding is one piece of the puzzle to delivering more of the housing that we need in this community, and there are a lot of other actions that we can take to address the crisis of affordability. And those are everything from seeking efficiencies in administrative work and infrastructure delivery to projects and to sites that are planned for development, to looking very specifically at our code and what we are currently incentivizing through our fee structures. And, you know, doing that hard work of looking at why it is that we are commonly generating a particular type of housing that is not particularly affordable, and what we would need to do to steer the housing market towards more units that are accessible broadly in the community. So it's, I would venture that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of actions that this community could take, small and large, or small to large, that would remove barriers to improving housing affordability. And those two others that I mentioned, I mean, obviously increasing supply is one, but expanding the diversity of housing that is available to people and available to people earning local wages is absolutely critical to addressing this crisis.
And this will be our last question.
Rob Zako, City Club member, and my question is, can you help us understand how big the housing crisis is? Can you give us a sense of how many people in Lane County are affected by troubles with affordability? Emily, you talked about 20% at the bottom, $600 rents, and said maybe 17,000 additional units are needed in Eugene. And Karen, you talked about the Alice report and 44%. So how many people are we talking about here in Lane County that have housing problems? Thank you.
That 44% number, and I will add also that each year in recent history that the Alice report has been completed, numbers have gotten worse. More of our community is living at the safety net. That 44% of the community that is in poverty and living at the Alice threshold or below is about 65,000 households. This is not a small number of people in our community. It is not a small number of households. And the work that we are doing is not for the benefit of a few. It is for the benefit of the whole and the benefit of this broader community. 64,600 and some households.
Thank you. I'm sorry, that had to be our last question. Before we thank our speakers, I'd like to, for an excellent program, I would like to remind you that next week we have candidates for Oregon House District 11. Marty Wilde and Mark Herbert will be here. More details and information about the future of City Club programs can be found online at cityclubofeugene.org. Now we can get to thanking our speakers, Emily Ryman and Karen Knudsen. That concludes today's program. In compliance with Eugene ordinances and Oregon state law, go Ducks.